The purpose of a business is to have a customer. Who are my target customers and what are they looking for, and fully solve their problem?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. If you've seen the movie 21 or read the book Bringing Down the House, you'll be familiar with MIT's legendary blackjack team that inspired both the film and book. Turns out being a blackjack prodigy is not only really cool, but it can also help when assessing and managing risk in the business world. Yuchen Li, a member of that famed blackjack team and current CEO of Allego, is here today to tell us all about it. He's led a very interesting life and now leads the company to help reps become better salespeople in our remote world. Allego is also recognized for how their enablement platform has helped train medical professionals to use ventilators during the pandemic, which is really cool, and we're going to talk about that. His current success with Allego and past experience with his startup Unica prove him to be an effective futurist, so I wanted to have him on to discuss everything from blackjack to AI learning. Here's Yuchen. So Yuchen, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to ask you how it is that you define your work. Who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
My primary role right now is the CEO of a company called Allego. We help our customer succeed by providing them a learning and enablement platform to help them train new hires, launch new products, manage sales teams every single day, and excel at virtual selling, which is more and more the requirement now in selling.
And I love that. I think that obviously you've had a strong record of being able to anticipate things that are going to be big in the future. So I want to talk to you a little bit about that. But I think first off, I was curious what attracted you most about solving the problems that Allego is focused on.
Yeah, for a longest time, businesses feel like they want to put the customer at the center of the universe, and that's how they become successful at it. I've always come from the point that in order to have successful customers, you got to have successful, good employees and highly engaged employees. At Allego, we said we have a belief that success at work is fundamental to human happiness. And to some extent, what we're trying to do is to help not just build a great company, but help other businesses succeed by having successful employees as well.
Yeah, I think the idea of the successful employee is one of those things that has definitely been like a little bit of a different light, especially the last year. And a lot of companies having workforces that all of a sudden were shifting to remote overnight. And you had a lot of companies that were doing a good amount of hiring and trying to onboard people and get them successful. Were there any lessons from the last year? Was this a net benefit to you guys in terms of growth? How did that pan out?
Yeah, Jeremy, a year ago, if you ask people, can everybody work remotely? And we still function as a society, people would say that this is just crazy. But here we are, right? A year later, everybody learned and this new normal. And it's like anything, there's new muscles that people need to build. What we found collectively is that people are equal, if not more productive in a number of industries, having employees be able to collaborate remotely. And I think part and parcel of this has to do with how do you think about the nature of work? Almost like decompose work down to smaller chunks and then figure out what is the substitution of those chunks in the virtual world. And we're able to really help working with our customers to figure out what are the set of processes and technologies. For example, if you got new people that are hired during this pandemic, some of these people have never even seen their colleague. How do you even mentor or coach them, manage them remotely? All these are new things that need to be figured out. But I think collectively, we have shown that it is possible. In fact, you can do it so well that many people are questioning, even after the vaccine, after we get back to normalcy, will we go back to the old world again, or would it be more augmented by some of the virtual work that we're doing today?
It's interesting because it's almost like nobody ever questions the conventional logic, or at least most people don't. So there were all these people who said, of course, everybody has to be in the same office 24/7 getting work done. And nobody questioned it until everybody was forced to question it. And now it seems there are a lot of people who are like, why didn't we do this sooner? Yeah. It is interesting. I mean, how does somebody, and I know that you've made some big bets during your career, no pun intended there. How does somebody train themselves to just question everything before you have something like a pandemic that forces, you know, us to embrace something that we wouldn't have embraced previously?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think even before the pandemic, there are companies that have been doing virtual work for quite some time. They sometimes have the CEO in a totally different office and location from their executive team, and people spread out all over. So there are models like that. It's just that in general, to support such a work structure, there need to be a general paradigm and a whole set of technology, a whole set of understanding beliefs that collectively people need to adopt. And that's, I think, the hurdle that we went through before the pandemic. Nowadays, it's almost like, I tell you, you know, sometimes I bring new hires to a business trip before the pandemic, and they don't even know what to wear. They don't even know not to check in their luggages. There's some basic stuff that we take for granted in the old world. And to some extent, there's some new skills people need to learn in the new world. And part of what we're trying to do is to help our customers collectively to figure out what are the key components they need to do to be successful in this new virtual world. And that is really the exciting part of our business going forward.
I think it's true. There are a lot of things that you take for granted that everybody, of course, they're going to know this. And I know a lot of people who started new roles and new ventures and where they have to onboard their team. And there are all these things that it's this knowledge that's in their head, but you can't assume that other people are going to automatically know it. You've got to find a way to accelerate in order to just have your team at, you know, peak efficiency as soon as possible.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Jeremy.
So I know one thing that a topic that you're big on is the idea of AI-driven learning, and maybe we could talk about that. What exactly is AI-driven learning for those who might not be as familiar, and why is it going to grow in importance in the years ahead?
Yeah, to simplify, think of it as a way to leverage data that we have about how people learn, how they interact with learning content, and leveraging that intelligence to predict what are the areas that this person will be best at in learning, and therefore accelerate and personalize how learning is done. It's almost like instead of taking an entire class of new hires that come on board and train them in the same pace and the same set of content over time, you very quickly figure out who needs more help in what specific area and bifurcate that training, target each individual. That's really the heart of it. It's almost like having your own private tutor, if you will, but except doing this for thousands of people.
I know that you've got an understanding of AI better than some, and probably me too, but I think you're probably 10 steps ahead of me. I hear a lot of worries and fears about all of the downside of AI. And of course, we've got to be aware of some of those things, but still you feel that the pros outweigh the cons in that regard, right?
Yeah, I guess part of this has to do with what types of data you're collecting and how are those predictions get performed based on which specific elements of data. You could build biases into models or doing predictions in area that one shouldn't venture into. From our type of business, which is not consumer oriented, we're really talking about what skill sets are critical for employees to be successful at work. What are the content they need at the moment they need it? Those are pretty cut and dry business value. That doesn't even come close to where the line is when it comes to ethics or anything else. I like to stay on this side of the line and solving business problem more than all the other social issue that comes with AI and machine learning.
Now, I think that's a really good point. And yet, obviously, even with business, perfect example is like you can build bias into anything and have it lead to negative consequences. People point out that humans are imperfect and therefore AI will be imperfect. And my only, you know, point to that is like that doesn't stop us from inventing anything else that's going to try to influence society. So maybe we'll take two steps forward and one step back, but is that not what, you know, invention is most of the time?
Yeah, it's a messy business. It's never a straight line. And I think part of what we're doing collectively is also learning from our mistakes as we create these tools to really help us do a better job at excelling at what we do. it's never going to be a straight line. And I one of the motto at Lego is that we value our mistakes. And so part of this is really to figure out what is the right answer as we go forward. But the good news is that these type of technology have shown tremendous promise and value to businesses. And I don't think those return on investment conflict at all with some of the more problematic area that we worry about. And we're able to really steer the business focusing these technology, use it for good, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. When we talk about good, I had heard even that your platform had helped train medical professionals to use ventilators during the pandemic. That's a perfect example of using technology and leveraging it in a positive manner.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. We basically, back last year in April, when we first found out that there was a need among the healthcare providers that there's so many different models of ventilators out there that people all of a sudden are overwhelmed on what to do with the different models that they didn't know they even have. And they have urgent need for it. We put together this app to be launched in Android and Apple that in 10 days, from conception to launch in 10 days. And we have 95% of all the ventilators that are being used out there and the instructions of that for them on this device. And it's now for almost 100 different countries are using it. Over 100,000 people have used the application for good. Things like that can only be possible with technology. And it takes a lot of hard work, focus, energy to make something like that happen. So we were very proud of part of that project last year.
No, absolutely. And the time to market with that is, you know, fantastic. I think one thing that's also interesting, as you're selling technology, you're often selling people things that maybe there's some sophisticated buyers and then there are some that are less, and they don't quite get necessarily what's under the hood and why it's beneficial and why it's going to help drive business value. What's your process to try to explain to people how this is going to benefit them when they don't necessarily get what's under the hood 100%?
Yeah, Jeremy, what you're asking is at the heart of selling. And that is to first understand what stage is the buyer at from their journey, if you will, towards understanding how to solve a particular sets of problem. And the other is to understand, truly understand what problem is the buyer looking to solve. We call that the buying journey. The seller needs to immerse in the buying journey. And as part of that, we figure out some buyers are very sophisticated, well on their way, and you can then therefore engage in a totally different path than somebody who just say, what is sales enablement? How do I teach my team to sell virtually? How do I onboard them virtually? How do I train them virtually? If they're at the very beginning stage, then our job as a partner is to really educate and to provide information and nurture their engagement with us. And we want to be a trusted advisor, really, to help them and accelerate their understanding of the space. And so we do a lot of that in selling. We tell our sales team, if you do your sales job really well, it feels like a service to your prospects and customers. And that's what we're trying to do.
So switching gears a little bit, but actually in some ways not at all, what was the genesis of founding Unica? Because I know that seems to be a pretty significant part of your story.
Yeah, Unica was founded in early to mid 90s, focusing on machine learning, actually. That was our first product. It was called Pattern Recognition Workbench, and it was a machine learning product to help analysts using data to predict machines or financial markets or various usage of that technology. And then we focus our energy halfway through our journey in marketing. And to us, it's the same problem, right? We're trying to make sure that marketing, instead of blasting and create lots of junk mails and spams, can marketing be so targeted, using technology, be so targeted so that marketing feels like a service? So thematically, I would tell you, you know, if you look at my career, it's all about, can we make marketing more like a service? Can we make selling more like a service? It's all about really matching what ultimately give value, which is value to your customer.
I think that when you put it that way, there's like a through line that makes a lot of sense for sure. I think a lot of people, all, you know, when they're trying to figure out how to build something, they're always trying to think what's something that's going to scale, that's going to add a lot of value to the customer, but then also that's going to have enough value to the business world that they can make, you know, exit at some point. Is there a secret to building something that a company like IBM might want to purchase for $500 million, give or take? What's the type of thought process you need to have to say, this is a thing I'm doing, and I believe it's going to be 10 times bigger a few years from now?
Yeah, the favorite sort of perspective on that for me is from this strategist that I really respect called Peter Drucker. He said, the purpose of a business is to have a customer. And to me, starting a business, building a business is all about figuring out who are my target customers and what are they looking for and fully solve their problem. That laser focus is super important. A lot of times I have entrepreneurs come to me and say, hey, I'm facing with all these challenges. And what I typically find the most dangerous strategy is one that's where the entrepreneur doesn't have enough confidence in a customer. So they end up picking 10 customers. So they end up spreading themselves out so thin and they end up not solving anybody's problem. For anybody who's starting businesses or think about being business, narrowing your focus and fully dedicate yourself and your business to solving a class of customers' problem as good as better than anybody else in the world. That to me is the secret to success. It takes a lot of guts actually, because Jeremy, there's no more hedging. You know, if you fail in one group of cohorts, you have no backup, if you will. But that is what it takes to be successful, to dedicate yourself to a whole segment of customer holistically.
I think as somebody who used to run an agency, I agree wholeheartedly. And that's why I got out of that business, because that's the kind of business where people come to you for a project and they're not a lookalike with your customer base that you're serving already. And then before you know it, you're diverted in one direction and then another. And it doesn't allow you to be, you're basically reactive as opposed to proactive. And if you're proactive, you can really get that laser focus that you're talking about.
It's hard to be good at something if you're trying to be good at everything, right?
Absolutely. Completely true. And yet what's interesting is that a big part of your bio is being good at blackjack. And then yet you were good at other things as well. But it's that's just my way of transitioning. I'm curious how often you get asked about bringing down the house and 21 and that whole part of your story.
Thankfully, a lot less now than before. But it is a fun subject for me. In fact, this pandemic, I've taught all my kids how to count cards because we've got nothing to do at home at times. When they turn 21, maybe we'll go hit the local casinos. But at the end of the day, it was a fun experience for me. And one always raised eyebrows whenever we talked about it.
For sure. I think that it's a great story, but I also think that I'm sure that there's a kernel of something in there that makes you a better decision maker. How would you say that somebody, if they were to be a blackjack prodigy, like how would that make them a better decision maker, hypothetically speaking?
Yeah, so a couple myths I want to put forward. First is, you don't need to be a graduate from MIT to do this. Anybody can do it. I'm convinced I can take anybody, spend 6 months with them and train them to be a professional blackjack player. That's point number one. And point number two, this is not illegal. It is using your brain. You're not cheating or anything. It's just you using statistics to help you with the game. In terms of lessons learned, one of the hardest things, Jeremy, to really stomach in blackjack is the volatility involved in the game. You could have an advantage over the casino, but you can still go to a casino and lose tons and tons of money in short runs. Now, if you keep visiting the same casino over a long period of time, eventually you'll win. Similar to how a casino eventually will win, even though you may walk out of a casino after a few hours and winning some money. So that law of large number, scientifically, is called, and be able to stomach the volatility in between is the hardest thing that I have ever gone through. Losing tons of other people's money in these teamwork that we had as part of the team. It's really hard to do. But what it ended up teaching me is the fortitude to deal with things like the pandemic, like recessions. I've gone through 4 different recessions and 2 wars in my career, and there's a lot of up and down. And building that fortitude to know that your true north is still your true north. This is just temporary, and over time you'll get better. That taught me a lot through that experience.
It's interesting. Somebody once put it to me that casinos are like insurance companies, in that basically any one individual is pretty difficult to win against the insurance company. But on the whole, the insurance company will win out against all of the people that they're paying out. And the same thing's true for casinos. So
exactly right. That's exactly the algorithm. And to some extent, blackjack team operate like a casino, like an insurance company. Individual player may win or lose in short period of time, but over a long period of time, we actually end up winning.
Yeah. No, I think it makes a lot of sense the way you put it. I wanted to ask you just in closing, because obviously your goal is to look pragmatically, and especially like we were talking statistics, right? So if you're looking at statistics properly, you're going to be making better decisions. If you can eliminate bias as much as possible, or at least be aware of your own personal biases, that will help you make better decisions and see the future and see where things are going a little bit better. So I'm wondering, how do you personally correct for your own biases to make better decisions on an ongoing basis?
So, Jeremy, I think the key there is to make sure that all dissenting voices are heard when you make decisions. In my experience, the larger the organization, the harder it is for the CEO to hear what people are really thinking and disagreeing with the CEO, if you will. And part of that is ingrained in our culture. But what I'm trying to do when I build companies is to make sure that people understand, hey, it is actually your job to disagree. And I joke with my team all the time to say, I'm going to make 10 to 15% decision mistakes. And I'm going to count on you to tell me when I'm making those mistakes. In fact, it's your job to tell me when I'm making those mistakes. Now, it does two things. One is give them a license to disagree with me. And two, I don't have to walk around all day pretending like I know everything and every decision I made is right, which is very tiring, right? So by freeing up people's willing to dissent, it's messy, but you end up making a better decision when you have that type of work environment.
Love that. I think it's also interesting. I don't want to say that it's insecurity on the part of some people to not be able to surround themselves with other smart voices, but I generally think if you have surrounded yourself with some very intelligent, capable people, then why not hear their voice? If not, you basically paid for a resource that you're not leveraging.
Yeah. It's hard. Emotionally, it's hard for somebody to tell you wrong. And to this day, I'm not 100% there. And it's a work in progress always. But we still got to do it.
Yeah, I think those are really great words of wisdom. And hopefully, I will take some of this to heart and some of our listeners will as well. So, Yuchen, this was really fantastic and very helpful. So thanks so much and best of luck with everything going forward, now that you need it.
Thank you. That was fun.
Thanks again to Yuchen for making the time. I really enjoyed this conversation. Very wide-ranging, as I'm sure you'll agree. If you'd like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producer Aaron Cohen. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.